I'm opening?
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity.
Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
There we go. Classic.
Hello,
you don't know what this is. They live in a box.
Then you don't watch movies. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we are doing a very special episode, as indicated by the music. We're not doing Ghostbusters.
But we should.
One day we will. Today, we are celebrating the life of Harold Ramis, who passed away for us just within this week.
Yeah.
But for whenever you're listening to, obviously, the time is different. But as someone who... oddly enough, is fascinated death. I don't think every death has to be tragic, and I don't think we have to be here and be mournful and be just sad. I think there's so much to Harold Ramis in particular that's so joyous, especially since he does comedies, that we can talk about it with a bit of humor,
and a bit of fun,
as Robin Williams and Patch Adams would say.
Wonderful.
So Harold Ramis, what's great about him, there's so many aspects that we can discuss with him, you know, through his writing, producing, directing, acting. There's so much to talk about, and I know you guys are fans. Dimitri Panos, welcome.
Hello, everybody. Don't cross the streams.
Don't cross the streams. Sarah Stretton.
Hi, everybody.
She has not seen Stripes, however.
I have not seen Stripes. Machi.
And we'll have Marissa in the booth chiming in every now and then.
Hello.
She's a fan of Ghostbusters, as you can tell.
I mean, who isn't, though?
I don't know. There was talks of third one.
Yeah, that's still going on, believe
yeah,
it or not.
Ghostbusters still has quite a following.
We'll talk about because of Bill Murray.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. I don't know. We'll talk about Ghostbusters and what may or may not happen.
Well, let's talk about this, you know, and fans, this is where you kind of more or less get to participate as well. We're going to give our reasons why we like Harold Ramis and what movies in particular we're fans of, and also what initially, you know, it's always interesting, what initially got us into him or what was our avenue to kind of first as an introduction. So, Dimitri, let's start with you.
Okay.
Since you're 2 years older than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Thank you. Where to begin?
You know, when I tossed the idea out to potentially do this, you know, I thought celebration of life but then it sort of kind of got me depressed. Because I was thinking, man, we collectively have lost somebody who I know for me impacted my life as a really young kid. I was always a moviegoer. And if you've read my biography on Anatomy of a Movie, it goes back to like when I was 5 years old. But just growing up through the mid-late 70s, being introduced to certain comedy. I mean, there was the birth and genesis of Saturday Night Live. And from Saturday Night Live, my friends were like, well, you've got to watch this other show called Second City Television, which introduced me to whole new other bevy of actors. So, I mean, Saturday Night Live, you had Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Bill Murray, Garrett Morse, like Lorraine Newman, Gilda Radner. And I think I just mentioned the original lineup of the not ready for primetime players. And then, you know, on Second City Television, you had John Candy, Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, Harold Ramis, Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara. You had a great talent of comedic. It was just a great gene pool of comedy going on. And so when this movie was coming out called Animal House, which was going to star John Belushi, and I was a big fan, I was around 11 years old. The movie was R, and it was rated R at the time for proper reasons. You know, God bless my folks and my parents and my dad. You know, they allowed me to go see it. And my dad bought tickets for me and two of my friends in my neighborhood, and we went to see Animal House at this theater. We actually saw a double feature that day. It was a theater in Salem, right next to my dad's shop. He bought the tickets for us. He let us in. We saw Slapshot with Paul Newman, also a very rated R movie. And then we got to see Animal House. And Animal House changed. Animal House was one of those defining moments of movies for me that changed my life of comedy. I got to see John Belushi. It was sexy. It was raunchy. Over half the jokes went right over my head, but I got all the physical comedy aspects of it. And it wasn't just because I got to see like boobies on screen and all this ribald, like raunchy stuff happening. I mean, there was great dialogue. There's just great moments that I ended up quoting, and I was just so, it was great. And it just furthered my appreciation for that kind of comedy. And I fell in love with John Belushi and Tim Matheson, I was introduced to. And at the time, yeah, I recognized Harold Ramis's name, but I knew he had a hand in writing it, but I didn't know the guy at all, other than, hey, this is the guy in Second City Television. So as the years went on, then, you know, following Animal House, another one of those movies was coming out that I just had to see, Saturday Night Live Connection, Caddyshack. And this is one that Harold Ramis wrote, and he was directing, and I see this movie Caddyshack, another rated R movie at the time. And I know I'm forgetting Meatballs, because this is where I learned about, prior to this, Ivan Reitman, Bill Murray again, who was from Saturday Night Live, and, you know, Harold Ramis wrote that, and it was a great camp comedy. But then we go into Caddyshack, another rated R movie in which my dad took me. I know exactly where I saw it. It was in Laconia, New Hampshire. We were on summer vacation at my Uncle Marty's condo, and it was a rainy day, so we went to go see Caddyshack. And, you know, Rodney Dangerfield, Chevy Chase, Brian Doyle Murray, Ted Knight. I mean, another movie that, again, just as a kid, I laughed my ass off. And I was like, this is great. And when I went back to Peabody, it was playing at the Peabody General Cinema. And, man, I had to go see it multiple times. But there were times that I couldn't get in. I tried to sneak in because it was rated R, and I was not 17. And I didn't necessarily look 17. So one of the ways, I would ask somebody, hey, you going to go see Caddyshack? Would you mind buying tickets for me and my friends so we can go see it too? And some people would say, get away from me. Or other people would say, okay. Or we just buy a ticket for another movie and try to sneak in. Got to remember, back then, we're not talking multiplexes where, you know, you can't track where somebody's going. This theater had three screens. You went to this screen, or this screen. It was very easy for somebody to see you buy a ticket for the movie that was over here, and then you had to walk all the way across over here. So I got thrown out a couple of times. And it was for a movie that I had seen. And then Stripes comes along. And this is when I see Harold Ramis on screen. And he was every bit as funny to me. Like, Bill Murray was the star. But I always likened myself to Harold Ramis's character. He was in the background, a little bit sarcastic. And he was always the guy that would just walk on and go, hey, what's going on? All right. And, you know, again, another comedy that he had a hand in writing. Ivan Reitman again. Directing, and, you know, comedy genius. Like, these movies, to me, when I liken them back, like, they're just lightning in the bottle, because you're getting all these great creative people, comedic great people, together to make these movies. And we're not seeing that today, like, you know, like it was in the 70s, 80s, where all these people just collaborated. And then, of course, Ghostbusters comes out. In Ghostbusters 1984, if I'm correct, you know, it changed it all, because you had ghosts, a little bit of horror, you had great special effects that wasn't overmarred. Like, the movie was never overmarred by the special effects. It was always about the comedy. Mm-hmm. And Ghostbusters, to today, I mean, people still can watch Ghostbusters, laugh their asses off. It's funny. You know, what was great too was there was the character development. There was dialogue. Like, it was the way somebody said a line. Like, you know, the cats and dogs living together. I mean, that's great stuff. The, you know, the talk about, well, like, imagine this Twinkie. You know, that's a very big Twinkie. You know, stuff like that, even to me, right, even today, it just makes me laugh. So Harold Ramis, to me, he was a person that he just afforded me the gift of laughter. To me, there's no greater gift. And there's no greater gift that a person can have to be able to do that. And he just seemed like a really down-to-earth, nice guy. Everybody seemed to really like to work around him. He was a solid director. He got what he needed to get done. Wasn't over flashy. Some people say his other movie, Groundhog Day, which is a great movie. Really good, timely story, a love story, you know, and one of the all-time, you know, greatly written comedies. And I don't know, when he passed away, when I got the news, when I saw the news, I was affected. You know, many actors die. And some of them you're like, oh, that's too bad. He was really good, or she was fantastic, or, you know, she was old, she had her time. Shirley Temple passes away. You understand her legacy. There are other people that when they've passed away, that and Harold Ramis is one of them, they're one that had an impact on my life. They had an impact on how I viewed comedy, on the way that things made me laugh. I never had that gift. I never really had the gift to put pen to paper and to write skits and do that. But I did have the gift of being able to sit in a movie theater and watch and rewatch and rewatch and continue to laugh and come out and talk about it with my friends and continue the laughter. And so for Harold Ramis to pass away, for me, that really affected me in a way, because when I was thinking back, there wasn't a time that he wasn't in my life, in a sense, going to the movies as a kid, and how these movies affected me as a person, and how they affected me growing up through junior high, high school, college, and going forward. I will always reckon back to Animal House being my very first rated R movie, and my parents allowing me to see it. And I'll always look back at Caddyshack and think about the snobs versus the slobs, and I'll always look at Stripes with John Candy, another person who I actually felt when he passed away. That was another one. You know, John Hughes affected me when he passed away, because such a part of my life growing up, you know. So, yeah, I coming in to do this show, you know, trying to be happy about it, but I got to do some really great research. I heard some great quotes. I got some great quotes from Harold Ramis as a person. And I'll open like with this one. This was great because it really describes the kind of guy that he was. When you look at his movies that he starred in and he wrote, he was never the guy that wrote himself in to be the star. He was writing like for Bill Murray or for somebody else, and he collaborated with Bill Murray very greatly. And this quote sort of sums that up. He goes, you know, everybody asks me if I was the class clown, and I always say no, but I wrote for the class clown. And that says everything. That says I wasn't the guy that needed all the attention, but when I knew who was funnier than me, I would latch on to that, and I could write for that person to make that person funny. And I was just the guy in the background, like going, hey, yay, he said what I wrote in paper. And that really sums up his career and how giving he was and how talented he was. So, yeah, today is, this whole week, it's just been, I rewatched Stripes. I bought Ghostbusters, bought Groundhog's Day. I went in a whole Harold Ramis thing. So for me, he will be missed. Yeah. So it's all right. That was a long thing.
I mean, I think that's great, because he affected your life so much that you have so much to say. I mean, for me, I did not grow up with his movies. I was introduced to Harold Ramis through the wonderful world of home video. And I first got into like his more iconic pieces, sure. His involvement in obviously Caddyshack, National Lampoon's, Animal House, Ghostbusters. First and foremost, Ghostbusters. That was kind of one of my go-tos as a kid. I think probably a lot of it always went over my head, but I loved it.
Yeah.
it was just catchy and funny and fun, but also obviously a little bit scary. And then for me, Harold and Mrs. Burke has always just been kind of like growing up around people who are studying like film and want to be filmmakers. It was always something that people looked up to and like wanted to follow and wanted to follow in that legacy of being able to leave behind, as you said, just times and times of fun and laughter. And I think being that I did not grow up when they were released in movie theaters, but that I still watched them made his life like an accomplishment. Like, he did leave those behind. They are timeless, so you can keep watching them. And that's just so great. He made huge steps in comedy, in creating this, you know, you felt like you're watching a network of friends who's just continued to make these great pieces. And as someone who's like an actor and a collaborator and who works for a lot of people who do improv, it's easy to connect to, and it's easy to see that friendship and the love they have for it. And I think the best thing that you pointed out is I'm not really the funniest gifted person at writing comedy, but I do love to laugh, and it's such a great gift. And like they just say, not only does it improve your health, but you know, laughter is one of the best things for you. So you just have to admire someone who can just push out and be involved with so many great comedies, like year after year through the decades. And I think that's really incredible.
Great legacy.
And while we're on that, you know, other people have cited him obviously as their influences: Jay Roach, Adam Sandler, Bob Farley, Peter Farley. So, you know, obviously he's influenced a lot of other comedians. And in particular, Dimitri, you had mentioned, and I want you to talk about this, four out of the top 100 AFI comedies are his.
I mean, and this is incredible. I mean, and this is something that, you know, I never pieced together on my own. I just found it out today. And so catch this. So out of American Film Institute's 100 funniest movies, Harold Ramis was involved with four of them, one being Ghostbusters, no surprise, 1984. That came in at number 28. Groundhog Day, 1993, that came in at 34. Animal House, 1978, came in at number 36. In Caddyshack, 1980, came in at number 71. Now, it's also important, it's also fun to note that Meatballs, Stripes, Back to School were all nominated, but for whatever reason, I mean, how you don't get Back to School? Back to School is hysterical. You know, they were nominated, they didn't make the list. And that's the other great thing, too. You start to play connect the dots. Rodney Dangerfield, Chevy Chase, they were in Caddyshack. Bill Murray obviously was in Caddyshack.
Well, here's so Dan Aykroyd has been used three times.
Right.
John Candy twice.
Yep.
Chevy Chase three times. Brian Doyle Murray, one, two, five times. Robin,
you might take the cake with that one.
We'll get there. Robin Duke three times. John Flattery three times. Eugene Levy just twice. Andy McDowell just twice. Bill Murray, one, two, three, four, five, six. Six times.
Yeah. And again, it's just going back to that lightning in a bottle. When Ramis was starting out, you know, he was editor of the joke section of Playboy, and then getting into National Lampoon, getting involved with the Second City Troupe out of Chicago. And when he's in Chicago, you know, that's where he meets people like John Belushi. He meets John Candy. He meets, like, Gilda Radner. All of these fantastic, wonderful people were coming out of Second City. And then who's the producer? Lauren Michaels is putting together this sketch comedy show that's going to be live on Saturday nights. It hasn't been really done that late at night before. And Harold Ramis had this to say. He was putting together the crew, and he's taking like John Belushi and Bill Murray and Chevy Chase and all these people. And he said, he was asked, like, how come you weren't asked to go into Saturday Night Live? Because it would have made perfect sense. And he goes, Lauren Michaels, like, he didn't want it to be an overly ethnic-looking cast. He said it. He goes, but you know, he goes, it's all the timing. He goes, at the time, I was also working for Second City Television, which was filmed up in Canada. And he was like head writer. He goes, had I gone to Saturday Night Live, he goes, I would have felt like a traitor. Like, he goes, I liked working with those group of people. And Saturday Night Live is a great show. And he goes, but I had something very special going on here. And from Second City Television, you know, he wanted to write. And one of his best, one of his closest friends, collaborator Doug Kenny, who's also in Animal House, he played Stork, the real sort of geeky one. He was he was the one that became the band leader as they're marching down the street. Well, what are we supposed to do, you moron? That guy was Doug Kenny. And Chris, I think it's Chris Miller, who was writing for National Lampoon about fraternity life, and that's what the genesis of Animal House became. Yeah, they started, you know, he took a little sabbatical from Second City Television, and they're like, hey, let's try to write this, and they knew that they had something good going. So, you know, it's funny that, no, he didn't end up on Saturday Night Live, but look at the talent pool and how he used them, how they were in movies that he was involved with in one way, shape, or form. That doesn't, you know, Judd Apatow has his favorites, but not such, I mean, when you talk about those people in comedy, like, to, you know, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, every choice leads you to where you are. And like, obviously, he wasn't on Saturday Night Live, but he did some, he just did so many amazing things and went on to so many amazing projects. Mm-hmm. I was going through his records of just all the movies he did, and just in the movies he directed alone, for those of you who like numbers out there, on IMDb, the U.S. gross for his directed movies, not his written, not everything else, it was $426 million.
Yeah.
And then if you're adding like Animal House's U.S. gross, which was like 141, and Ghostbusters was like 238. I mean, I'm like, these movies are getting towards the billion-dollar U.S. gross range. I'm like, so he wasn't on Saturday Life, but he did do all of this.
Oh, yeah. And he's most thankful for the career that he had. Exactly. And when you talk about gross, you're talking about times like late 70s. They weren't tracking grosses the way that they track them today. Movies weren't being released. Like Animal House had so many numerous after releases in the theaters. There was never aftermarket. There was never video, you know, especially late 70s, early 80s. So it wasn't an uncommon thing that a movie could be released multiple times throughout a year. Like, it would come back in theaters and play another circuit. You know, I remember that happening with, like, Saturday Night Fever, I should say.
You follow it around.
It was a movie. Yeah, I mean, it could play, be taken out, then it would come back. Star Wars, that happened. There were many re-releases of Star Wars in the late 70s, early 80s to get it back out in theaters, and Animal House is being one of them. So, yeah, I mean, so when you talk about the grosses that his movies that he directed, you know,
it's not even everything. It's just what we know.
That's just what we know. And some of those movies were, well, you know, they were not high grossing movies. Mm-hmm. They were flops. Yeah, you know, they weren't. Like, a Club Paradise did not compare to a Stripes, or I should say, to like a Groundhog Day or Vacation or Caddyshack. And there's another funny thing. When we talk about Vacation, and I already mentioned John Hughes. John Hughes wrote Vacation, another Chicagoan who, you know, so that collaboration, again, it's just lightning in a bottle that you get all these people together. And Brian Del Murray was also in Vacation, as well as John Candy, and, you know, helped launch. Yeah, so it's really funny.
The whole little crew.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
I mean, it's not really a little crew. It's a big crew. Some heavy hitters.
It's, and they're comedic geniuses. Like, I can watch Uncle Buck or anything that John Candy's in, almost.
You mentioned Judd Apatow, and I want to kind of transition slightly to that. In the respect that, obviously, Harold was in Knocked Up.
Yeah.
And then, you know, speaking of Judd Apatow's collaborations, he, obviously, Michael Cera. And year right. one in particular.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I know obviously we've been talking heavily about, you know, his big works, but I think even like Bedazzled still has a legacy. Yep. And year one for me, whatever it may have been, I enjoyed it.
I definitely watched Bedazzled. I was Brendan Fraser. There we go.
Yes.
Which is a remake of an English comedy of the same name, Bedazzled, that I believe starred Dudley Moore. Mm-hmm. I believe.
But yeah, you know, and again, I think that was fun. Then Analyze That, you know, always gets credit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Analyze This, yeah.
And Analyze yeah. That.
Yeah.
So,
you know, again, I just wanted to kind of mention those, you know. So, you know, it's nice that we've obviously been talking about these guys, but, you know, in the new age where you have, you know, with Bedazzled, you have Elizabeth Hurley and you have Brendan Fraser. And then in year one, you have Michael Cera and Jack Black.
Right.
So, he over the span of his life, he did obviously, you know, continuing all the people he got to work with. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, Jack Black in particular and Michael Cera as well. I mean, those are great sure. comedians.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And if you look at the cast of year one, too, there were a lot of like cameos going through that of, you know, who in modern times were, you know, up and coming comedians or, you know, popular comedians of today. I think Richard Cross, is that his name? Who's a comedian, and he in fact introduced Harold Ramis at this institute, which it's a question and answer, it's a Q&A that he did, and it was a retrospective of his career. I sent the link to you and Marissa that we can post up on the Harold Ramis thing. It's about it is an hour and 20 minutes. Keep it on in the background. There's some great information there, great quotes, and then you really do get a sense of the kind of gentleman that he was. So, but yeah, you're right. He knew enough about comedy, and you know, he had a good eye and ear for it.
Yeah, you know. One of the things that I want to transition into is Bill Murray, because we've kind of touched upon him, but obviously they had, you know, star of Groundhog Day, and then kind of going back to that, you know, Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. But it started from, you know, John, unfortunately, he couldn't be here today, but he was telling me the story of what a pain it was to work with Bill Murray on Groundhog Day. The story that he tells me is that Bill, for all purposes, really wanted to be a serious actor more than a comedy actor. And so he, with Groundhog Day in particular, he wanted it to be more of a philosophical movie rather than, you know, a comedy. And perhaps, you know, through their argument, perhaps luckily we got a great movie that blends both.
Sure.
So if anything good came out of that.
That's the upside.
That is the upside.
That's the upside.
But from what I'm being told, you're saying that it started back in Ghostbusters where they're splintering, as we can say.
Yeah, that Q&A that I was telling you about, he actually candidly talked about Bill Murray, and I had heard about their breakup, so to speak, and I had heard about Groundhog Day, you know, and you're right, Bill Murray did want to be taken as a serious actor. I mean, he really did something that at the time. Well, a lot of people, like Steve Martin, had tried it, and I think Steve Martin kept at it so to some more success, but Bill Murray put out this movie called The Razor's Edge, in which I believe he also directed. It was like his directorial debut. He starred in it, and it was a more of a dramatic turn for him, but it was a flop. People weren't buying it. And, you know, Bill, you know, he's had a reputation for not being the easiest person to work with. And on Ghostbusters 2, Harold Ramis was talking about it, that Bill was on the set and you just didn't know who you were going to get on any given day. And, you know, he said, look, he goes, I'm not giving away secrets. People know that he can be difficult to work for. He goes, when he's fantastic, it makes life easier, but he can be mean. And he was like making people uncomfortable. He was sending people back to their trailers or homes in tears. There were times it was very difficult to work on Ghostbusters too. And, you know, and he mentioned Groundhog's Day. And what I found interesting was that Bill Murray wasn't his first choice. He didn't necessarily want him. He didn't think that he could really pull it off. And he was actually, I guess, a little bit nervous to work with him. He wanted to go with Tom Hanks. And they wanted to go with Tom Hanks, who was, you know, at that time, he was on his big rise. And, you know, he had some good comedies under his belt as well. But it just kept on nagging as he's working on the script. He really couldn't think of anybody other than Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. And Bill Murray liked, and he came on board. They got him to come on board. And again, apparently, Bill Murray, too, was also going through a very bitter divorce at the time. And on Groundhog Day, he was very difficult to work with. And the way that I have heard the story is that he actually took Bill aside and said, look, because you got to grow up. He's like, you know, you got to stop making people's lives miserable here. He goes, we got a job to do. He goes, and I understand you're going through a lot, and I'm here for you as a friend. He goes, but you got to back off. He goes, you got to do your job. You have to stop this. Like, man up, do your job, be professional, stop being so hurtful and angry towards people. He goes, because it's affecting this job, and I have a job to do as a director to get this movie in. And apparently, Bill Murray didn't like the talking down to, and ever since then, they hadn't spoken. Those kind of situations to me are sad, because you figure that throughout the years, when you look at their collaborative effort, you knew that they were good friends. And mm-hmm. it's sad that as you get older, that perhaps they never really reconciled. And Bill Murray's tweet when Harold had passed away was, at the same time, it was sort of nice, but at the same time, it didn't lead to much emotion. You know, he just basically said he was a good man, he earned his keep in this world, God bless him and his family, or something to that, and that was it. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't write anything. So obviously it seems like there's still some anger issues there. You know, that's life sometimes, but you would hope that time usually heals a lot. And mm-hmm. you know, who knows if they could have gotten together again, but it's sad that they didn't.
I think that it would have been interesting, because there had been so much talk about the next step for maybe another Ghostbusters, and if they'd be able to reconcile and kind of work together again, and it was in the works, or like at least in talks.
Yeah.
So who knows?
It's been in the works. Ghostbusters uh-huh. 3 has been in the works for years, and Bill Murray was on Howard Stern, I would say about a year, 2 years ago. And Howard Stern, being, you know, a fantastic interviewer as he is, he just kept on. So what about Ghostbusters 3? What about Ghostbusters 3? And he goes, well, you know, he goes, have you even read the script? And Bill Murray was like, well, it's on the top of the pile. He's like, you haven't even read the script? And he got Bill Murray to admit. He's like, look at my career. How many, like, sequels have I done? And when you look at his career, if you want to discount Garfield, because that's like a voiceover work, the only sequel he'd ever done was Ghostbusters 2. And if you watch Ghostbusters, it's nowhere near the class of the original. And he's like, I don't like doing sequels because of, like, Ghostbusters 2. And he went on, you know, it wasn't particularly the best experience, and the movie speaks for itself. And I don't want to put myself in a position to make something that's mm-hmm. not good. You know, on one hand, I can respect him, but on the other hand, you still have great talent. You had Ramis, you had Aykroyd, you know, Reitman was in. So you had these collaborators that, okay, maybe they can pull it off one more time. Last I heard after his passing, that Sony is rewriting to try to figure out, but mm-hmm. Sony seems to be going forward with it.
At this point,
I'm like, can you recapture? Because this movie was supposed to be like a passing of the torch.
Yeah.
Can you get actors who are of that ilk? Can you capture that spirit? I'm not entirely sure, you know.
Because it was fun, you know, as you said, it's kind of horror sci-fi, but with comedy, you know. And so that is really tough to capture, especially with four people. You need a good ensemble.
Yeah. You need a very good ensemble.
And even, you know, you had the secretary.
Yeah, Annie Potts.
And then
Rick Moranis.
Yeah, exactly. And so you had all these side characters who were just ridiculous.
Yeah, and they were equally as funny. Like, you can look at Ghostbusters. Bill Murray's clearly the star. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he clearly has some of the best lines. You know, one of my favorites is, she sleeps atop of her covers. 4 feet on top of her covers. You know, I look at that stuff, and again, it still makes me laugh. But then when you look at Dan Aykroyd's, you know, performance and what he's, you know, don't look into the light, Ray, and things. And then when you look at Egon, you know, Harold Ramis, again, Harold Ramis had something really funny to say about Egon. He says, I look at myself in stripes, and he goes, I was like smiling and laughing in pretty much every scene I'm in. And he goes, and that's just the sign of a, he goes, that was the sign of like, an actor who's like an insecure actor who's just trying to like get along. And so he mugs a lot, but he's smiling. But to me, that's part of the charm of stripes. It was when we sat down to do Ghostbusters, I made a promise that I was never going to smile. And that's about as close right behind us. That's about as close as a smile that you get from him in Ghostbusters. And he played it straight. Yeah, but you know, you throw in Rick Moranis' character. Okay, who brought the dog? You know, it's got great. Like, they gave comedic bones to everybody, stepped up to the plate. You know, Ivan Reitman's direction was fantastic. It's a movie that's around the 2 hour mark, but it never got tired. You know, and you know, when the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man comes down the street, I mean, that is just great. And the rewrites that he talked about that he had to do, you know, Dan Aykroyd had this whole thing with the Ghostbusters, and he said the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, he said he comes in the movie at about 15 minutes in, and he kept on getting bigger and bigger as the movie. He goes, you know, we didn't have the budget. He goes, we had to rework this. So, you know, I'm glad that Stay Puft stayed in there. And yeah,
I agree. It's iconic.
It's iconic.
I have a friend who's currently, they're doing, even before Harold Ramis' death, just to show you, they were doing a Ghostbusters exhibit in an art gallery in LA, and they're like commissioning new art for it. And this is just on the wave of, it's still just a huge cult following that people still want to know about, and that's why they wanted a Ghostbusters 3. It's because people still are talking about it. And it just has legs.
It's funny, Lego is coming out with Lego Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been video games, and listen, in the 80s, that the circle with the cross, you know, what was great about that is that circle with the cross was making its prominence. You were starting to see it. So when you put a ghost in there, that was just like, that was great satire of that. And then, of course, who are you going to call? Everybody was wondering, who are you going to call? And that song, like, number one song on the charts for weeks, like, for weeks on end. And that movie stayed around for weeks. Weeks. Oh, and it was a video. Again, this was, it's, again, lightning in a bottle. MTV was making huge waves. And when you got the stars of the movie to be in the video, I mean, you know, you're selling soundtracks, you're selling movie tickets, because people would go back. It was PG. I believe it was PG at the time. And, you know, it was, yeah, you got people just across, you got a great cross section. You got men, women, dates, kids. You know, boys, girls, cats and dogs living together. It was awesome. We
well, that's the joy of laughter, right? Brings everyone together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fun little fact. He was in High Fidelity, but his scenes were deleted.
Nice.
He played Rob's dad.
Oh, did he really?
That's
very interesting.
Again, all deleted.
That's too bad.
One reason or another. I don't know the reasons why.
Unfortunate.
I want to talk about his directing, because as you mentioned, kind of, you know, with comedy, again, it never gets the credit that it deserves, but many of people's favorite movies do, and, you know, we're right at around almost Oscars, and, you know, you have so much talk about all the great movies, but comedies never get the due credit that they should.
No.
And it is unfortunate, because in some sense, right, in terms of directing, like, it's simple in terms of cinematography and editing. Like, you don't have to go to that great length, although you could do some funny stuff, perhaps, like, in particular, the other guys I'm thinking, right? They did a fun thing with their montage where they did, like, a bullet time thing. So there are ways to spice up comedy, but you don't have to. Mm-hmm. And so the brilliance is in, as we've been mentioning, in just being able to direct actual actors.
Yeah.
And bringing out their...
bring out the moment.
Yeah. Bring out their talents and more or less just capturing it.
Yep.
That's it. Mm-hmm. That's all you have to do. And, you know, in particular, you don't really use close-ups. You stay more wide, especially like with the physical comedy. That's where you want to be.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you do bring up a good point. They don't... You're right. A comedy director, it is different because it is about the nuance, you know, more so today, because physical comedy today isn't what physical comedy was.
He cited the Marx Brothers as his influence.
And the Three Stooges.
Yes.
Were very much, you know, and yeah, and a lot of Marx Brothers, Three Stooges, physical comedy. But it doesn't translate today like Blake Edwards movies, like the Pink Panther movies and 10, for that matter, which is really big. You know, he was a big physical comedy director, and it doesn't really work as much or as well today. And you're right. He had a funny story about directing. Caddyshack was like the first movie that he was going to direct, that he was asked to direct. And he's like, I really didn't know what I was doing. And he goes, we're out in this golf course and we had everything set up and I'm looking in this green. And I just go to the crew. I was like, hey, he goes, what if we point the camera? What if we put the camera and point out that way? And he says, all of a sudden, I started getting these looks from the crew. And somebody goes, so then you'd want us to move all the trailers and everything and move them over there? And he's like, what would you do? He goes to the cinematographer. He goes, where would you put the camera? The guy says, well, I would put the camera over here. He goes, that was my one of my most important lessons in directing. Surround yourself with people who know what they're doing. And he goes, directing is a bunch of like solving problems and answering questions, but a good director should know when to ask questions too. Always rely on your people. And I thought that was a great story. And talking about actors, during Caddyshack, it was never scripted for a scene for Bill Murray and Chevy Chase to be on screen together. And John Peters, who is the producer of that, said, we need to get these two together. Well, at the time, there was a rivalry going on between them that came to fisticuffs on the set of Saturday Night Live. And they really weren't on speaking terms. So Harold Ramis was like, okay, we'll see how we can figure this out. And he talked about, all right, we're going to set up a scene. I want it to be in Carl Spackler's. That's the Bill Murray character's. He goes, I want him to be living in like a garage and we'll get this. And he got the production designer, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase himself, together to hash out the scene. And it was mostly improvised. He said, they showed up. He goes, Caddyshack as a movie. He goes, we went for it on that scene because it really makes no sense in the movie. He goes, but the two of them together, he goes, it really is screen magic. And then he compared it to John Landis, who directed Animal House. Mm-hmm. He said, Landis, he goes, believe it or not, people always ask about how much improv went into Animal House. He goes, John Landis is he really sticks to the script. And he goes, it really isn't much. He goes, but in a movie like Caddyshack, they let people go, and on Stripes, you know, you let them, you just let these people work
play.
And you know, you never know what you're going to get. So I found his insight on directing comedy to be very, like, it's just, I liked his philosophy. And I always do find, though, too, because I always believe, as if you're in a leadership position, you're only as good as the people you have around you, truly. And you have to rely on those people. And yeah, he says, hey, you answer a lot of questions, but you should also ask a lot of questions of the people who know better than you. And one other thing he said about comedy, he's like, I was in Second City TV and that troupe, and I wasn't the funniest guy on the block. He goes, but what you do is you find out who is funnier than you, and there's always somebody funnier than you, and you stand next to him. And I'm like, hence the quote. He goes, I was never the class clown, but I wrote for the class clown. That's perfect. A great thing. Yeah.
Sarah, any fun stories about Harold that you want to share?
I feel like he's captured a lot of them. It's like, for me, it's just the funny stories is how much that it's still prevalent today. I mean, I went to a school where Greek life was quite large, and we always referred to one of the houses as, I believe it was one of the models for the Animal House, the actual set. It's one of the houses at USC. And so as you would walk down the road, everyone would be like, oh, but that one's like Animal House. That one's Animal House.
Delta.
And it's just like all the references that it's still getting, these jokes and this play, and everything's just continuing. It has such like a life of its own, I think is wonderful. And that to me is the funny part, that it's just that real life wants to resemble these crazy comedies and take after them and make them real on everyday scenario to me.
To that point, as we wrap up, and you know, I like doing this because it's important, and the reason why I like doing this, you're mentioning there's so many references to his movies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, how many people go toga, right? I mean, what was that movie with Jack Black? Be Kind, Rewind, right? They parodied Ghostbusters and things like that. So I really hope that people do get to know Harold Ramis' work as an original piece of work rather than through something else, like a Family Guy or whatever, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's great that they can get introduced through it because it keeps getting talked about.
I'm glad, but sometimes people don't take the time to find the referential material.
Right.
And so, it's all of his work has been parodied in so many different aspects that, mm-hmm. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen some of the work, definitely check it out.
Like, I need to look up Stripes.
Yes.
This is the one I need to see, guys.
Yeah, and looking on this thing, I forgot another movie that he did story and screenplay, Armed and Dangerous. Okay, now this movie starred John Candy and Eugene Levy. And funny movie, not a big movie. Oh, and it also starred a wicked cute Meg Ryan, who was in this movie as well. And again, when you're looking at the Second City Television people, like, again, what a troop of comedic people. You know, Eugene Levy went on. He worked with Ron Howard.
What did he do for Armed and Dangerous?
Story and screenplay.
Ah, gotcha.
So, yeah. I don't know who's going to do. I mean, parting thoughts from me would be as, I don't know, for whoever's listening, I don't know, family, friends of Harold Ramis. I mean, for me, it impacted my life in such a positive way. I can't. You know, I look at comedy through his writings and through his movies, and I will continue to do so. So, you know, he will be missed for me. And all I can say is, be the ball. Don't cross the streams, because that would be bad. And Mr. Ramis, you can look into the light now.
And I will give a parting thank you. Thank you for making so many people laugh. And for all of you who haven't seen all of his movies, look out for them. And I think that after this, we might need to watch one to get a few laughs, brighten it up. On to you, Phil.
We didn't talk about his international appeal, but I know in particular, my dad being European, they love like movies like Vacation. They love Chevy Chase and things like that, and Animal House. So and Stripes. You know what I mean? It had that kind of comedy, which is great. Translated, languages.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And you, other people across the world could find the humor, which I think is a little bit more rare these days.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
Just Animal House, going back one last thing for Animal House, when he was writing it with Doug Kenny and such, one of the things was, it was a turmoil time. We are coming out of a lot of those Vietnam. And so when they wrote Animal House, he's like, we wanted it to be political, but we took the politics out of it. He goes, it really is about rebellion. And it really is. He goes, but when we started hearing that other frat houses and that Greek was becoming like the big thing, everybody wanted to be Delta House. It was like, wasn't sure we wanted that. Like, he goes, we didn't want those kind of Delta. He goes, but we're glad that the spirit of rebellion is what, really goes forth.
Oh, yeah.
So, there you go.
All right. Well, on that note, don't be sad. Cry tears of joy, not tears of sadness.
Tears of laughter.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Enjoy Oscars. We'll be back doing more movies and things of that nature, but we felt this was worthy of an episode. So until next time, follow us here on on Twitter, on Movie Anatomy, and visit anatomyofmovie.com for all your movie dissections.
There we go. Oh, you know what it's gonna...
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.
Thanks for watching Anatomy of a Movie on YouTube. For more on your favorite movies, subscribe to our channel here, and be sure to let us know what you think in our comment section below here. Bye.